Welcome to the Phase Space Invaders podcast, where we explore the future of computational biology and biophysics by interviewing researchers working on exciting, transformative ideas. Today I'm joined by Julia Palermo, a prominent group leader at the University of California, Riverside, renowned for her pivotal contributions to understanding the molecular intricacies of the CRISPR-Cas9 system. I remember meeting Julia at a conference several years ago, where she was just establishing her lab, and a very good friend of mine decided to join her group as a postdoc. Since then, it was a real pleasure to observe the great research that came out of that interaction. So our conversation revolves around the fascinating challenges that are specific to such multi-scale systems as Cas9, a protein where allosteric chemical reactions, large conformational changes, sequence recognition, and mutagenesis all contribute very important roles to the biological and biomedical function of the complex. We also venture into the broader revolution in RNA science, where new discoveries are constantly shifting the paradigms of cell biology. Finally, Julia is making a point that for truly transformative science, we need to rethink creativity and sometimes go against our formal training and scientific habits to arrive at real breakthroughs, even if that means keeping a pet project in a drawer for a decade. So, let's go. I hope you like our discussion. Julia Palermo, welcome to the podcast. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Milos. Thank you for inviting me.
So, in previous episodes, we've already talked about the perils of idolizing Nobel Prizes, but your research after starting in the De Vivo group and then with Ursula Ruthlisberger took a very interesting turn when you went on to work with the team that started the CRISPR-Cas9 revolution. And the Nobels aside, I was an undergraduate myself back then, but I remember very clearly that when that science paper dropped in 2012, it was promising to change everything in biotechnology. So do you mind sharing the story of how you became involved in this collaboration?
Yes. So I was a postdoc at EPFL in the group of Ursula Ruthlisberger. And I was writing a fellowship to join the group of Andy McCammon at UCSD. So I was in the process of developing a project, a computational project to study with the tools developed by Andy McCammon. And I was reading the literature about interesting things to study. So Ursula gave me a lot of time to actually develop my own ideas, and she was very generous. She suggested to study something that was related with viruses, but I was not completely sure I wanted to study the dynamics of a virus. It was not something that excited me. I was very excited about the interplay between protein, RNA, DNA, and so I started reading the literature better. And once I found this system, I found this paper. And what was very intriguing of this paper is that everybody was interested in it, but nobody could understand how it works. Because at that time, it was very early in 2015 or 14. Nobody knew how it worked. And I was very interested in understanding literally how it works, right? How it binds nucleic acids, how it cleaves. And I thought, this is going to be my project. So I sent an email to Andy McCammon and I said, I want to write a fellowship on this project. And he said, oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, we should do it. We should do it. And it was very encouraging. So I wrote this fellowship, which had a lot of, initially, people were not really convinced that it would be successful. I remember that reviewers saying that the system is too big, you're not going to get reliable, reasonable dynamics, the system is too big, structures are too poor, this project is going to fail. And this was a little bit disappointing. But on the other side, I knew it would have been successful. Because I knew that, the system is big, but we will initiate starting looking at the dynamics of the system. Then we will look at the open questions and maybe we will use free energy methods to study each open question, there is still a lot to do with refining the cryo-EM maps. So I knew it would have been successful. I knew it from the first day I saw a cover on Cell about it. I saw that cover and I saw a protein, half resolved, half solved, then DNA, RNA. You know, once I saw that picture, I knew that would have been my project. So
there was a clear
vision
there.
That's how we started. Yes, and then I contacted Martin Ginek at University of Zurich. And he helped me with supporting the experiments that we would do during the fellowship. And then I went, I got this fellowship from the Swiss National Science Foundation. I went in the lab of Andy McCammon. We started refining the structures with cryo electron microscopy refinement methods. We studied large scale conformational dynamics with a new Gaussian accelerated molecular dynamics method. And then once I met Jennifer Doudna, because she visited UCSD, and Andy introduced me to her. And she, in turn, introduced me to her now former student, Janice Chen, who is now a very successful founder of companies of gene editing. And so I started working with Janice, and so that's how it went, yeah.
Great. I think I know a lot of cases where this kind of vision or a dream of addressing some big problem in science drove scientists for many, many years in, you know, crossing the frontier.
Yes. You know, and sometimes you also get a little bit upset, right? When you get this review and say, this is impossible. And you think, you know, what I thought is, you know, I had this, the way how I reacted. You know, I thought, what is he talking about? This is possible. He says that this is not possible because he or she or they want to do it. No, I'm going to do it first.
That's a good point.
That's what I thought, actually, you know.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
But that brings us to the, well, to the multi-scale aspect, right? We were kind of used to doing things in just a single way, which is you take the atomistic structure of something, you run an atomistic simulation, maybe with some restraints, and then you try to answer questions, but systems like Cas9 require a completely different approach. As you alluded to already, you have to integrate experimental data, you have to connect multiple levels of description because it's chemistry involved.
Yes,
so you need a quantum level, there's huge conformational movements, binding and binding events. So that's a perfect case for advancing the field for many, many years to come.
Yes, and that's why I also was fascinated by the system, because when I started, structures were not complete, right? So we had to work using cryo-electron microscopy tools to define the structures, add pieces of the structure that were not present. And this actually brings to a point that I think is very important, the fact that cryo-electron microscopy now is giving structures of systems in their native environment, which are very big, very large. And molecular simulations now have to cope not only with the timescale problem, but also with the size of the system, right? We cannot anymore think that we are going to do some transformative work thinking that a small ligand binding to a small protein, which is something that has been done for so many years, right? But if we want to do something transformative, we really need to go toward what experiments are doing, sometimes even be better than experiments if we can, right? We need to be very bold and very courageous under this point of view, studying larger systems, large-scale conformational changes, and also how these very large systems bind with each other under long-range effects. For instance, something that I think now would be very timely is Brownian dynamics. This idea was very futuristic when they implemented it, I don't know if 20, 30 or 40 years ago, when they first had the idea of Brownian dynamics. Now it's very important because you have this very large system, you want to know how they associate with each other. And I think this is one of the frontiers that we want to pursue. But another frontier is certainly studying these systems holistically from the very small conformational change or catalytic aspect that is happening at the active site level to nucleic acid binding that happens on larger scales, for instance, for which we have to integrate IOM and refining methods, quantum mechanics, free energy methods, all together to establish the mechanistic function.
Right. I think for me, the biggest transformative moment in my understanding of molecular biology came when I understood how small or very tiny energetic preferences can give rise to those huge movements, right? That some contacts become established that are very weak initially and they can propagate. And we have this tendency to think in terms of preconceived movies that things know how to move, things know how to rotate, how to open and close. But in reality, there are those very tiny, very subtle forces at play. And I think this is the biggest challenge for these multi-scale methods, right? Because you want to retain the detail, but also gain the large picture.
Yes, exactly. That's why I think in computational chemistry and biophysics, every contribution is important. So the contribution of people that develop methods to reach higher accuracy is very important. But at the same time, is important the contribution of people that want to push the frontiers of what really computational biophysics can do, right? So of where we can go in solving real problems. Mm-hmm. And this also brings us to another aspect that I think with our job, with computations, we need to give results and give answers that are real, so that can be really confirmed with experiments, but not only that, that can predict experiments. That's where when we can be really successful, when we can predict something that couldn't have been done with experiments or couldn't have been done with such a timely fashion, or maybe would have required much more expensive equipment experimentally.
Right. This seems to be now the holy grail that we're approaching.
Yes.
Having predictive power in terms of
completely agree.
Modeling future results and guiding the experiments. We've also had a few comments in previous episodes of the podcast exactly on this point. So definitely this is the right moment to start thinking about this very deeply. And that brings us to the second point that you mentioned initially, which is how we need to get creative about our scientific ventures and how the future of biophysics or computational biology will not just rely on doing more of what we're doing today.
Yes.
But also on coming up with completely new ways of handling the problems, right?
Yes, because the way how we are pursuing science in general, not only as a computational biophysicist, but also people in structural biology, synthesis, what people do, people like to work on things where they, when they are comfortable. It's like your mind gets comfortable when you do things, when you read things, or when you pursue things where you are fine, you're comfortable in. And this is how we pursue our science, right? We are comfortable in what we are doing, but when we really get an improvement is when we get out of our comfort zone and when we put our brain in a situation of instability, when you basically try to reach a peak out of your plateau, of your comfort zone, you try to push hard to get to another level and ideally to get a paradigm shift in what you are doing. So this requires, I think, not only formal training, an excellent formal training in terms of math, physics, statistics, but also creativity. And creativity, I think, goes beyond formal training. Sometimes formal training is completely against creativity. And you have to be able to embrace creativity to be transformative in science, I think.
It is interesting because it kind of reminds me of the sparse rewards problem in reinforcement learning. Because you need to put in a lot of work that goes against the typical rewards of the field, right? So you're not getting grants by doing something that's completely out of the box, but you need to invest a lot to get the reward at the end, which might be getting to something completely distinct.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Well, I think that clearly somebody that is supporting your work financially, any financial agency would like to not to throw away money, you know, in something that is not bringing to any relevant work, any relevant publication. So that's why I think for the funding agency, it's very important that you do solid work, work that will lead to publications. But at the same time, you have to think as a scientist. I think you can have a side, you can work on your main grant, on your main papers, things that will give you the papers, right? So you want to have your papers. First of all, you want to have your papers to move forward. But at the same time, you want to think at something that is transformative, that can lead you to new discoveries, right? So I think that what my lab does is to work in a very solid way on things that will give to my group members publications, which are also important for their future career. If they want to be, they want to continue in academia or industry, in any case, they need an excellent CV. And for this, they need publications. But at the same time, we need to do something that is new, is transformative, that can go against what people believe, people think, something that can be, transformative is the right word, which I came to know is a word invented by NSF.
No, that's what we're aiming for also within this podcast. So
yes,
very well. Yes, it's quite important to have your pet projects that sometimes can take 10 years to yield something that's publishable or even showable to the people around, right? But
exactly,
sometimes the amount of thinking you put over your, I don't know, morning routine in those 10 years accumulates to something that nobody else has thought. It is really hard. I mean, I appreciate a lot how hard it is to come up with something that nobody in the scientific community has come up before. So very often you think of something and then you realize, you know, oh, someone in the 80s already thought of that. And
it's true. Yeah.
We're really competing with a lot of smart people in the field. But what are your thoughts on like how to get creative?
So I don't think that we have to compete with other people because it's not an egoistic effort. So you are creative in everything you do. You put your creativity in doing your paper, you have to be creative in studying a specific mechanism. You can be creative in developing a DFT functional, right? You can be creative in anything. And this effort overall in the evolution of science at a certain point will bring to a paradigm shift. So I think we have to see science a little bit more broadly than with ourselves. That just us, right? Our selfish effort.
Yeah, hopefully there is a back and forth when someone gets inspired. Again, that's also what I want to do here, to cross-pollinate those ideas whenever someone has a pet theory or pet idea that they want to share with the community. I hope that makes other people interested or inspired. That would be a great outcome.
Yes.
So,
something that I'm also very interested in, if I can say, so we say the revolution of structural biology with cryo-EM and how we have to cope with that and be able to, this is a challenge, of course. At the same time, I think another revolution that really intrigues me is what RNA can do. I think this was shown through, of course, the vaccine, right? Mm-hmm. But if you read the papers in RNA biology, you figure out that there are so many new mechanisms that can lead to therapeutic strategies. And these mechanisms are so exotic with respect to what we were thinking is therapy. So we were thinking of therapy as computational chemists, as drug binding on the receptor, right? So every type of drugs binds the receptor. But now the field of RNA is bringing out so many new mechanisms. So many new mechanisms that are unexplored, that are unknown, where we can really say something, where we can even invent the mechanism. It's so interesting. And another thing that makes me excited is the role that microbiology is having, the increasing role of microbiology, which has always been important. But we are figuring out that in microbes, in bacteria, there are things that we did not believe they are in. Like, we thought bacteria and viruses are less complex systems with respect to the human cell, for instance, but in reality, there are so many things that bacteria can do. We have not yet explored them, and microbiology is becoming ever increasingly important to discover these biological functions and lead to new studies.
Yeah, of course. It's true that Cas9 came from a bacterial system, and well, they had billions of years to evolve with a very, very high reproduction rate.
Yes.
So that's a great playground for evolution. On RNA, I agree very much, because right now I'm switching to focus more on RNA myself, and sometimes even figuring out the abbreviations of all the types of RNA that exist is, you know, illuminating. You didn't know that such a thing existed, that such a mechanism existed, until you read that there is an RNA classified as something, and then you have to study really the whole mechanism of how it works to understand what it does. Yeah, it looks like really the next boundary of what biology and biomedicine will try to use to push the boundary of therapy.
Yes, using biology to cure biology. So
yes, and again, you know much better than me that the Cas system is much richer than just Cas9, right? So there are many, many functions or many, many tools that are RNA-based that you can find inspiration for from these bacterial systems.
Yes, now nucleic acid detection, RNA imaging, these are all fields where CRISPR systems can be applied, not only gene editing, but also, as I say, the nucleic acid detection, imaging, these are also very important fields.
Right, which were the other proteins from the family? I remember Cas12, right, was involved in, I think,
Cas12.
Shredding RNA, or what was the function?
Yes. So we studied Cas12. Cas12 is another very interesting system, because this system paved the way for nucleic acid detection and was actually instrumental during COVID-19 pandemic to develop detection tools that were very rapid in detecting the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Another very interesting protein that differs from Cas9 because of the presence of a single catalytic site, and there was a burgeoning question: how could the system cleave both DNA strands if one was so far from the active site, which is something we studied using Anton-2 and free energy simulations. Akash Shaha from my lab just published his paper on that. Another system is called Cas13. And Cas13 is very interesting because it's a system that targets RNA and is used for RNA imaging and detection. So this system had a very intriguing allosteric mechanism that we were interested in studying. But while we were studying this allosteric mechanism, we found that specific residues could help the selection of the target nucleic acid against off-target sequences. So we proposed to Mitchell O'Connell at the University of Rochester to study the off-target effects mediated by these mutations, and we found that these mutations can improve the selectivity, and we also patented the variants. Yeah, I think the field is exciting.
Sounds amazing. So many tools, so many applications, and for every combination of tool and application, there's also so many modifications you can study. Okay, Julia, it was a pleasure having you on the podcast. Thank you for the amazing conversation and for sharing your thoughts, for sharing your ideas, and have a great day.
Thank you, Milos. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for listening. See you in the next episode of Face Space Invaders.